What's happening, y'all? This is Connie Morgan with the Free Black Thought Podcast. Today's guest is Nikki Johnson, MD, a healthcare reformer and advocate for medical integrity. She has collaborated with organizations such as Free to Care, Physicians for Patients, Urgency of Normal, and Restore Childhood to champion patient-centered care with an emphasis on support for families. And she was recently named Fair in Medicine's interim director. This happened after we recorded the interview. I didn't necessarily expect this, but this episode has been one of the most educational ones I've done yet. Nikki schools me on the difference between nurse practitioners and physicians, why it matters, and where there are healthcare discrepancies no one left, right, or center is really talking about. I feel like Nikki is the epitome of a free thinker because remember, there is no such thing as the Black perspective, just Black people with perspectives.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.
Hello, Nikki. Welcome to the Free Black Thought Podcast. Super excited to have you on here today. You're involved in so many things. You're working on so much. There's a lot that we can get into for this next hour or so conversation. But first, as usual, please just tell our listeners about yourself. How did you grow up? Where were you raised? How did your life story lead you to where you are today?
Hi, Connie. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate the invitation to come on. I am, going back to where I started and where I am. That's huge. But let's just start from the beginning. I'm the daughter of working class parents, and I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, in the Cleveland, Ohio area, a really small suburb. It's now one of the poorest areas of the city, but currently I live in Cleveland with my husband and children and our big old crazy Aussie. I grew up going to charter school. I started off in the public school, went to charter school, and then I ended up going to an independent school and graduated from there. Went to Case Western Reserve University School of Arts and Sciences, met my husband there as an undergrad. And I also went to medical school then right after at the same university. And that was just, mainly because I actually felt like medicine was a calling for me. I'm one of those people. I'm pretty spiritual in my connections, and try to, use that as a guide for making life choices and career choices, family choices, all of those things. So that's where I ended up, and being pretty close relationship, but also having some access to the medical school through the person who was in charge of admissions. I applied there. That's the only place I applied. So I applied early decision and got in, and went through all the training, and then ended up in practicing pediatric critical care, which is intensive care medicine for kids from all ages, from newborn up to young adult age. And some of that ends up being some older adults with some heart disease that's, that is kind of like childhood heart disease. Mm-hmm. So wide range, but I also trained in adult medicine and pediatrics before I even went into that specialty. Practiced that for a few years, and then in the intensive care unit, and wanted to slow down for my family and to be home with my family a lot more. So ended up practicing what is functionally like anesthesia, but it's outside of the operating room. So I was a procedural sedation doctor for pediatrics. Loved, loved, loved it. But in 2022, I was experiencing the culmination of what was a very, I'm going to say, traumatic experience being a physician that then led me to just leave clinical practice altogether. But there's, lots of factors that go into that. But part of that was, learning about how hospital systems are run, getting involved with advocacy for patients and physicians, and seeing how hospitals are doing things a little bit differently. And then the pandemic came in, seeing how the pandemic was affecting my family. So many factors, but ended up leaving that. And so I have not been employed by anyone since 2022. Technically 2023 is when my contract was up, but So this is where I am.
So why were you initially drawn to like pediatrics in general? Because to me that just, especially doing critical, it just feels so heavy, like dealing
with
sick kids. Like, how do you do it? Because I at once thought about being a doctor and I was like, I want to work with kids. And then somebody was like, well, if you work with kids, then you're going to have to probably work with kids dying. And I was like, okay, never mind. I don't want to do that. How do you handle that?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, my path to peds intensive care is pretty kind of long and twisted. I actually thought I was going to be a family doctor and work in my neighborhood in a little small medical practice in my neighborhood and take care of my people. But as I was going through medical school and training, I realized that that just wasn't for me. And a big part of that was the pathway that medicine was moving towards. It was moving towards more employed doctors working for these large health systems and not, you know, small practices. We didn't learn how to run a practice. And, you know, with time restrictions and reimbursement completely tied to insurance. And so it was, you know, you're giving 10 to 15 minutes for a follow-up patient. And then, you know, at most when I was training, it was 30 minutes for a new patient, but that time started dwindling down. And for me to be the doctor that I wanted to be, I just didn't see that happening. I found it really frustrating to have to practice in that way. So I wanted to do something that I knew I could make an impact. I could also have some fulfillment on a daily basis. And I found that in the intensive care unit. So I rotated through all the adult intensive care units and pediatric intensive care units. And I actually really loved trauma. I was drawn to that. I was drawn to the trauma and the abuse cases. And I know that seems morbid, but I felt like I could, I really connected with families. I connected with the kids. And kids actually, unlike adults, survive and are through their traumas and their medical illnesses much faster and more often than adults. So it was a lot, you know, so that made it a lot easier. I could see myself as an adult ICU doctor kind of getting jaded because, okay, you've lived this long life, you know, this experience, you made your choices in life and you chose this and this is how you're going to die. You know, like that's, you know, I could see myself, you know, getting that way. And you don't really have a great like connection to the family. In pediatrics, you also have a connection to the family and the people who care for your patients. So you're impacting not just the patient, you also the other people that are directly there. With adults, it's a little bit more mixed. For me, I was like, I was actually a lot more depressed in the adult medicines than I was in pediatrics. And yes, kids do die. That is a fact of life. It is difficult. It never gets easy. Never. I mean, I remember every kid who died in my care, and you know whether someone else was the primary, you know, doctor for them, or was a patient who was just a frequently entering the intensive care unit for one reason or another, that we sort of, you know, drew connections with. I still remember them. I remember them all. You don't forget that. But for the most part, I felt like it was, I thought I was great at it. I thought I was great at connecting with people and finding a way to heal people through talking with them, connecting with them, and actually then, you know, applying the skills and the knowledge that I had to kind of get them out of the ICU and, you know, back into regular life, or at least some, you know, new normal for them.
Okay. So you're talking about the way in which you were kind of forced. It was kind of like a factory sort of, you know, like get patients in and out. It's quick, it's dirty. It's, you're not spending the time. But is that really only in kind of more of like the hospital setting, right? If you had opened your own like practice, would you have been able to control
more of that? Not right now. There are so many regulations that control the practice of medicine, so much interference and bureaucracy that it is frustrating. And there's a lot of burnout in the practice of medicine in all fields, in family medicine, in internal medicine, you know, just for adults, and, you know, private pediatrics. There, you know, the requirements for the number of patients you have to see to, you know, to build up you know, a certain level of revenue. The whole payment structure in medicine, you're paid for procedures. The reimbursement comes in from insurance companies for procedures, mm-hmm. for procedures, for things that you do, for things that you order. For you to be sitting with your patient and talking and comforting and guiding and counseling and, you know, and working together to build a healthy life, that's not reimbursed. Like those are kind of flat fees. And so if mm-hmm. I want to spend an hour with a patient who's losing their memory or has some new problem that I don't have to do a procedure on, or the family has questions, if I want to spend that hour, I'm not going to get reimbursed for that. I'm only going to get reimbursed for a certain amount of time. And so you have to pay the bills. Especially if you run a private practice, you have to pay the people who work with you. You have to pay for to keep lights on, all of those things. And with mandates for electronic health records and certain coding and things that you need to include in your record keeping to keep the insurance companies happy and get that reimbursement, it really fully takes away from the experience. Prescribing medications, for example, if your patients have different types of insurance coverage, a prescription coverage, what you can prescribe is going to depend on what's on the formulary or the list for that, mm-hmm. Person's mm-hmm. insurance. And so you're going to have to remember those things. And it's tough. Like I couldn't prescribe the thing that I want to prescribe because my patient may not be able to afford, to buy that. Mm-hmm. Independent. And then again, along those lines, independent pharmacy chains have become these huge corporate structures too, that are kind of top down. So they are an alliance with a lot of the insurance companies in these vertical integration type schemes where they control the medicines that are on the formulary, which means they mm-hmm. control the cost of medications. So mm-hmm. There's so much in play that it's just making it difficult to actually be able to practice medicine in the pure way that it was intended. Now, but that being said, there are doctors who are, if they're not, close to retirement age like me, or they're younger and they sort of see that light, or they've been actually taught by people who know this information, they're going into what some people call concierge medicine, but direct primary care is really the more accurate term for it, a doctor, individual doctor or a spouse, a couple goes into private practice for themselves, and it's a cash pay system. And it really is it's just membership based without the medical sharing. So that's separate than the medical sharing. And so I have my own direct primary care doctor. She's a family doctor. She's young. She and her husband started their practice. I pay just for myself $90 a month. I get to interact with her with, email, text message, phone calls, visits, as many as I want in a month. Mm-hmm. I have, 100% access to her. They have a small panel, enough that they can handle. And so when I go and I visit with her, I'm sitting down, we're having a chat before we even get to the exam and do all this other stuff. So mm-hmm. it is, it's more personable. And it's really what I call, medicine, the thing that I ended up, initially wanted to go into medicine for, but it's not something that I can do with my specialty. So that was why I left it all together, because it's not easy to do that. And for me to be able to pick up and do that, I would really have to hire my own staff. It would just be too much. So I felt like I can make healthcare better being outside of it than I could while I'm in it. And mainly because being in it for me was affecting my health in a negative way, mentally and physically. So I had to leave it. There was no more trying to work within the system for me.
Yeah. So is there a place, that sounds incredible. And I've heard a little bit about kind of these cash-based doctors, systems. Is there a place where people can go to like find a list of folks, find a doctor near you?
There are a couple of websites, and just so right now I'm completely blanking on it, but DPC Action is a good place to start. There are these are doctors that I know and that I work with who are advocates for this stuff, and they like have links to places where you can look. But if you want to look for yourself, I mean, really the simplest thing is to Google or you know, go on any search engine and hit direct primary care, you know, doctor, you know, near me. And basically you'll, you know, you'll come up with the list. It's become much more popular in the last few years than it has been. So you may look out and find somebody. And then you go down the list and you call them, and a lot of them will do a telephone consultation first. Like, you don't even need to make an appointment and go in. And so you see if you like this person or connect with this person, and you want to trust this person with your care before you go in.
That's awesome. Yeah. And the first thing I'm thinking of actually is I've had a few babies and I've used midwifery care every time. And that's something that midwives brag about. You know, they're like, you're going to be in your appointment with me for an hour. You're not going to just be 15 minutes or whatever. Yeah. But our midwives, is that something that's just not as regulated, or they don't have staffs that they have to hire really? A lot of them just do it out of a small office. So the overhead's low.
So the nurse, you know, midwives are nurses. So they don't have, you know, the same type of training that obstetrics, you know, like doctors who go through obstetrics and gynecology training do. So they're limited in that respect. They can't do surgeries, you know, that kind of. And their licensing is completely different. So regulations on them, you know, are pretty much, I mean, they fall in the line of nursing regulations. Mm-hmm. So not the same as kind of, you know, medicine and doctors. So they're on a different board and are regulated differently, and every state is different. So and they don't, and because I mean I'm not sure how much, you know, they take an insurance base, or they do, you know, if they cash pay or not, but I'm sure some of it is covered by insurance too. So in that respect, whenever insurance is involved, there's some regulation attached to it. So you can bet that they have to follow those guidelines. But if they're in their own practice and they don't really have to, if it's just them, they're not really requiring a ton of staff and a ton of, you know, and ton of equipment and things like that. So, you know, you don't really have to see, you know, 10,000 patients a day to actually, you know, keep the lights on. So but that's one of those areas that I don't know 100%, you know, I'm not 100% familiar with, just because it's a completely different field from anything I've ever worked in.
Okay. That makes sense. And yeah, the overhead's low. A lot of times it is, a lot of them are cash only, or, only take very limited in the insurance that they take. So that makes a lot of sense. So you're a part of, I don't know which one we should talk about first. Because you're a part of a lot of different advocacy groups and working on different things, solving different problems.
We could do Free to Care.
Okay, let's do Free to Care first. Were you involved with Free to Care as you were transitioning out of actually like working in medicine, or did all these things kind of come after?
So Free to Care formed in, oh gosh, is it 2018 or 2019? I think it might have been spring of 2019 is when they first formed. But I had been involved in advocacy before that. I actually started off on social media and Facebook groups, like physician mom groups on Facebook. And, you know, and a lot of these groups, you join them, you know, the same with other like kind of parent groups. You just hear people complaining about things or having questions about things. That's generally kind of the group. And then often though, when doctors sit around and complain about crap, nobody does anything. We just complain. Mm-hmm. We just let it happen. And so I'm not that type of a person. I need to connect myself with people who are doing things about the problems that we're talking about. So I've discovered people who were advocating, joining, you know, forming their own grassroots groups and coalitions, and were actually getting started and getting, you know, getting to work. Mm-hmm. And so at the time, one of my, one of the people that, you know, and several of these people I became really close friends with, but one of the people I now call a friend was really upset and fired up about how she was getting care from a nurse practitioner, and in her state, that nurse practitioner was required to be supervised by a physician, but that person never was, and there was a diagnosis that was missed on her, and mm-hmm. she was severely ill as a result of that, had to leave her residency, and it just completely derailed her career and practice of medicine. And that, just, for me, opened my eyes to a lot of what was happening around the country. That there were a lot of states that had started granting legal authority for nurse practitioners to practice by themselves. And basically for us, you know, as a physician, we were learning that they were practicing basically medicine with mm-hmm. nursing degrees. And then some of them were starting to call themselves doctor and basically saying they were better than physicians. And it was just like, mm-hmm. it became this like battle on the internet. And like, we felt like there was a need to form a group that educated about this. And then, so from there I started, and that's where Physicians for Patients was born. But from there I started becoming a lot more educated about how the structure of healthcare is, like the corporate side of things, from top down, from the government involvement on down to the patient. And from there, Frida Care was born, and Frida Care is actually a large, it's a coalition of all of these smaller grassroots organizations. And so that's how that was formed. And the first conference was held in DC, where I co-authored a white paper on lowering the cost of healthcare. And that was presented to Congress that year. And then the group went around lobbying to different congressmen. But there was like, you know, presentations and question and answers. And then there was like meetings set up with congressmen. So that's when that started. And I was the leader and president of Physicians for Patients. And so we became a part of Frida Care. And from then that just sort of sparked my energy and fire for lobbying for changes in healthcare.
Okay. And so one of the goals of Physicians for Patients, which you just mentioned, so Physicians for Patients is one of the organizations that falls under Frida Care, because that's a coalition of a bunch of different orgs. So you co-founded Physicians for Patients, and one of your goals is to seek to increase the number of practicing physicians. Is that because many physicians like you are just like not interested? They're quitting practicing, or not enough people are going to med school to even enter the field? Gosh. What exactly?
Yeah, so there's multiple reasons why there is a gap between the number of physicians that are practicing and the number of patients that are out there who need doctors. This started long before, you know, 2018. This really jump started with the Affordable Care Act, believe it or not. But it was happening gradually. The nursing shortage and the physician shortage was happening gradually before then, because we were starting to get the older generation. The boomers were getting older. And mm-hmm. so you were getting more patients, you know, than we could handle. Right. So, but the Affordable Care Act gave all these people insurance, but they didn't have a place to go for to find medical care, right? So it didn't increase access to care. It just increased the ability for you to get access once access was there. And so when the Affordable Care Act written in there, the language to cover for the need of patient care for all of these new patients that they were going to insure, they chose to increase the number of nurse practitioners that were produced, and to have states start to enact laws that would give them what they called, you know, practice, you know, at you know, up to the what do they call it? The top of their license is what they call it. But basically, it was just expanding their scope, so they didn't need a physician to practice with them. And they mm-hmm. thought that these nurse practitioners, because one, it's cheaper. You got nurses who nurses don't need to go to undergrad for something separate and then go to nursing school. They go straight from high school to nursing school. And then to get a doctorate in nursing, then there was a master's that they could also have, but get a doctor's in nursing and practice, you know, fully by yourselves. It's only, you know, a minimum of 16 to, you know, to 18 months. And the longest case, in about 3 years of schooling. So it's pretty cheap to train them. They go and pair with a doctor, and they kind of learn, like, sort of like an apprentice during that time. It's just, and then they take a test and then they're done. Whereas doctors, it takes a lot longer to train us and to pay for us. And the government does pay for our training through Medicare funding. And so that's, you know, that sparked, like, that just set the ball rolling for states to start churning out and nursing schools, online diploma mills to start churning out nurses. And so from then, that exacerbated the nursing shortage. because nurses were, like, you know, graduating from nursing school and you know, telling their employer, like, what are your goals in 5 years? I want to be a nurse practitioner. And so, you know, and not to fault them, you know, that's probably what I would do too, if I were, if I were a nurse. But they were really changing sort of that landscape of medicine. And so that's number one. So there were no provisions in the ACA to increase physician training to scale up the number of spots for training for physicians at the time. So, you know, so then now we're falling even shorter behind in the number of people that we can take care of. And then a lot of these corporations, the ACA also mandated the electronic health record. There were a lot of physicians who retired because it was mandated to use electronic health record. It was slowing down practices. The overhead expense was high, and the upkeep and having to meet all the regulations was also really high as well. Because, you know, larger hospital systems can have people who just sit and, like, are responsible for compliance with regulatory compliance. Mm-hmm. They have people, that's their job to do that. Smaller practices can't survive like that. So a lot of the smaller practices chose to get bought up by big health systems, or doctors just, you know, hung their shingles and that was it. They were hung up their coats and left. And so there's that. And then also, you know, the boomers are growing. The boomers are also not only the boomers are getting older and retiring and getting sicker, because chronic disease happens more as you age.
Right.
Also, doctors were getting older and nurses are getting older and retirement. So then that exacerbates the shortage too. So, like, those are the, you know, they're kind of the three big reasons we had a physician shortage. And so that was, you know, but, you know, the Affordable Care Act and the Obama administration's idea was to build up more nurse practitioners and not build up more physicians. And we felt like it was a lost art, that, you know, we were really actually going to start losing quality of medical care, you know, in terms of what the physician could bring to the table and that kind of the physician led team as well. And we never set out to, you know, like, to be hateful or want to completely eliminate nurse practitioners ever. We never wanted that to be the case. We would get into arguments with people online, but that was never what we wanted. We want people to make their own choice, be informed completely about what this person can do for you, what's available, what doctors get trained to do, what nurse practitioners get trained to do. And we also saw this leading to a two-tier type of a medical system, where we thought that the more insurance-backed corporate-sponsored systems were going to have more nurse practitioners than they were going to have, you know, physicians. And then the people who could, and these are the people who are going to take care of the elderly, the poor, the Black, and Hispanic, all of the, you know, minorities. And then the people who and, you know, and that includes, when I say insurance, I mean that includes Medicare and Medicaid. And then the people who could afford it could pick their doctor and pay to see their doctor privately. And so I felt like, for me, I was personally charged with with wanting to educate the public about this because I felt like this was going to impact Black people. And that was really tough for me to see. And having grown up, even though I grew up in one of the poorest areas of the country, of the city in Ohio, there were local family practices nearby that people went mm-hmm. to when I grew up. And I started seeing that go away. And that was hard to see. Mm-hmm. And watching my own mom, who has diabetes, have to, forego her insulin for a month because she can't afford to pay for it. She's going to a doctor's visit, it was a request to see referred to a specialist. And when she gets to the specialist, there's somebody who's not a physician there who gets to see her. And she doesn't want that. She wants to see the doctor. And she has to be, forced to see this other person first who is not a physician. And it's a waste of her time. And that wasn't because of me. That was her on her own, And right. There's lots of people who don't even know the difference. They're just thrown into that. And that is, mm-hmm. that isn't fair. That's not their choice. Right. And so that's sort of got me fired up with all of it. Yeah.
And you're probably going to cringe at what I'm about to tell you, but nope. I'm one of these people, right? So growing up, our family doctor, using scare mm-hmm. quotes, was a nurse practitioner. Mm-hmm. We loved her. She took care of our family for our lives. But to us, I don't think my parents, or certainly not me, I was a kid, obviously, I just went where I was told, but we thought, okay, we're getting great care. This is normal. We don't have mm-hmm. a family physician, but it's fine. We have a nurse practitioner. So actually, I'm sure you could talk about this at length, but is there kind of a short and skinny on like how people should make decisions based on what care they think they need or will want, like whether they should have that nurse practitioner be there primary care provider versus a physician, and even a physician's assistant. I don't know if that just muddies the waters even
so
more.
I'm gonna guess. Let me just take a guess. Was the nurse practitioner you saw working with a doctor in a doctor's office?
I think so. Yes. Yeah. I'm pretty sure
So when this concept sort of first came to be, doctors were, in their offices were employing nurse practitioners to help with mm-hmm. well checkups and kind of minor cases, things like that And it's great. And honestly, there's lots of specialties that use nurse practitioners and they're amazing. I've worked with some absolutely amazing MPs that mm-hmm. I wouldn't, In their field, in their area of expertise, that were awesome. But all of them knew that there was something that they didn't know, and they mm-hmm. would ask for help. This newer crop is very different. They are being trained that they can do exactly what a physician can do. And they are being trained that they are being taught that they come out of nursing school and nurse practitioner training, and their certificate prepares them to do exactly what a doctor can do. And that's the problem. They don't know mm-hmm. what they don't know. And mm-hmm. every single nurse practitioner that I have met that has gone on, changed their career path and became a physician, once they start going through medical school, they all have said to me, wow, I didn't know that I didn't know all of this stuff. And so there is a big difference in the depth of training and even the style of training, even like the sort of the diagnostic pathway that nurses use is completely different than physicians. Mm. And there are things that nurses learn in nursing school that physicians don't learn. And that's what makes people trust them and love them and connect with them. And that's honestly very valid and a wonderful part that the nurse practitioner brings to the patient care experience. So I would never take that away from them, but they just don't have the same degree of medical knowledge. And there really is data that shows that even one family medicine resident, not like a full-fledged attending board certified attending, one resident can do the work of 10 nurse practitioners.
Oh, wow.
So it is, you know, it's a matter of efficiency, you know, not just, good quality. I mean, it's quality patient care plus the efficiency mm-hmm. as well with it. Yes, absolutely. Do I want someone who's going to like not brush past me telling them that something is really bothering me or something is hurting me and I need to discuss this with you privately? I don't want somebody to blow past that. Of course, I'm going to pick, the practitioner that will do that with me. Mm-hmm. I think the nurse practitioners in the very specialized fields and the physician assistants actually do a 2-year education, and they do follow a similar model as the medical model. Mm-hmm. So their style and learning practice is very different than nurses, because it's more of a traditional medical pathway. It's just shorter, and they were actually designed to be assistants to physicians. So that's kind of really what they were. But they're also trying to get their their unsupervised practice rights too. But that's the nursing path actually came about like really before physicians were a huge deal, believe it or not. Like nurse practitioners were developing before physician practices were. I mean, and nursing is a long it was a long history in the world. And so I wouldn't take that away from them and their skill and their ability. I wouldn't, but it's just not the same as having a doctor. And there are some things that they miss. There are things that doctors miss too. Everybody says that. And that's, okay. And there's times where you're going to need a second opinion, but when things are that would come natural for me as a doctor, even as a resident, for me to think down the lines of what's in the top list of things, if you come to me with a single complaint, that's completely different than what the nurse's list of things is going to be. And that for us is scary. I, for one, don't want my family being subjected to that unless, they know that this is a choice that they're making. Absolutely, as long as you're informed and you make that choice, go for it. I'm not knocking you for it.
Right. Nobody, but you're right. Like most people don't. I never thought twice about it. I was just like, nurse practitioner, basically the same thing as an MD, right? When it's not. And so I guess, is it fine if people have a nurse practitioner as their provider, as long as they're in an office with an MD, then they can have a little bit more trust in the care that they're getting.
So here's the deal. I mean, I honestly think when physicians get into these collaboration agreements with nurse practitioners, they really should be in a relationship where they, with that nurse practitioner, that nurse practitioner understands their limitations and knows that they can be comfortable with bringing those issues to their doctor, and they need to be on top of things. There are cases that the nurse practitioners make, which make, the argument for them being unsupervised easy, because there are doctors who abuse the system. And so in a lot of, in most states, the collaboration agreements that they make when they work together, especially in private practices, are very loose terms. It basically could just be a sheet of paper that the two of them agreed upon. These are the, this is when you, how many times you're going to call me. This is how many, how many patient charts I'm going to look at per month or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be in the office and see X number of patients. And it's different with every single physician nurse practitioner partnership, and it's different in every single state. And so people will never see a patient or never come into the clinic, and it gets abused, and they get reimbursed and paid for work that they're not doing. And but I think the safest and the best strategy is really to be in the office at the same time. They have their panel of patients to take care of. You have yours, but you're also available to help and see those patients. And any chart that you're going to sign off on, you need to be seeing the patient at least. And that's how I practice as a doctor with trainees. And so I felt like that should be the same way for nurse practitioners too.
Do you feel like as you're kind of like raising as you're talking to people and sort of like raising the alarm on this, that you get more attention when you bring in the fact that it will have an impact on Black populations and communities around the United States versus if you didn't bring that up and you just said like, hey, there's a difference of care between nurse practitioners and doctors. People should know about this.
Honestly, I am very jaded right now about this because I don't feel like we made a lot of headway at all in this issue. Every time we bring it up, it is like so for people who are in line on the kind of the nursing side of things, for nurses who are really experienced, like now I'm talking nurses with 5 to 10 years or more experience as nursing, they get it. They get it no matter what I talk about and when I explain it, because they know the difference. For nurse practitioners who were experienced nurses and then became nurse practitioners and know that they don't know some things and respect the field, they get it no matter what. But when I'm talking to politicians, honestly, what they want are healthcare packages that are going to make voters happy. That's what they want. So this is sort of a sexy topic that doesn't turn heads with politicians, honestly. And when it comes to the political right, believe it or not, well, I've had, you know, I've sat on a bunch of panels for, unless they're physicians, they want, and a lot of the think tanks actually on the political right want to push these unsupervised practice rights because they feel like it's giving patients lower cost choices. And when it actually is not lowering the cost of healthcare, they don't understand that. But like they're thinking this is more freedom and you know, and it really isn't, because the main driver behind this, believe it or not, Connie, is the middlemen in the middle, the pharmacy benefit managers are the entities that work with the insurance companies to set up the formularies and set up the people on the panel. So when you get a new insurance, you know, you look down the list and they tell you which providers are on your list. That's set up by the insurance companies, right? But it's also combined with the pharmacy benefit managers. So they're kind of funding this whole thing. And so for them, it's cheaper to have to get reimbursement. Also, when you have a group that's going to order more tests, order more antibiotics, order more procedures or referrals to specialists, that's going to make more money too. So, and that is what you're getting when you're getting nurse practitioners. So when you have CVS, Caremark, one of the big pharmacy benefit managers, when CVSs are opening minute clinics and they're running them with nurse practitioners, they're going to prescribe the medicines that are in that CVS, which are also on the formulary, right? like, so everything's going to go back to them. So when you look at this as and they form these partnerships with the insurance companies and contracts that we don't get to see, and they can get kickbacks off of them, and it's completely legal by the stark laws of the United States government, they can get money for it. So when you, that's the thing that we've started to make some success with free to care with legislators on, is that what's keeping the cost of healthcare high are these middlemen in the middle, the pharmacy benefit managers and the group purchasing organizations in the middle, and their lack of transparency. And so we are focused really on trying to expose them and limit their power. Because that is something we see is going to really change things, you know, in the course of healthcare, because the rest of this is not like, it's not on anybody's brain, honestly. I mean, like the Democrats will use it as a talking point. They'll say things like, you know, disparities exist in healthcare, but they don't really pass any policies that will actually impact change, real change there. So, you know, it just kind of like, it's like, oh, I didn't know that. It's kind of really what we get when we bring it up. It never is. It's you know, it's just, it's blown to the side, and it's been really, really frustrating. So I'm jaded that part is actually going to get any attention and get anything done. But I am proud of the work that we've been doing with, you know, price transparency, and getting Congress to at least write some good bills, you know, for these PBMs and the GPOs. But you know, let's see if things get passed.
So is the way for change has to be through political involvement, basically.
Oh, absolutely. Because a lot of this is government sanctioned stuff. Like a lot of the policies and regulations come straight down from government. I mean, just looking at when Trump was in office, Rita Kerr was actually instrumental in getting HHS to rule that hospitals have to publish their prices. This was through, you know, big, you know, grassroots groups actions, but that was one of our big focuses then. And again, that first year coming out was to get at least the transparency part of it out there, because so that would also give the direct primary care doctors, the direct surgery centers, the ability, because they all post their prices. You know what you're getting when you go in, when you're going to these clinics. It's all up front. You're not going to have some service and then the doctor's going to bill you later and tell you that the price is different than what it was that was quoted to you. But when you go into a hospital, a system, and you get care either outpatient, in and out same day, or you go in as a patient to have a surgical procedure, you don't know what the price is going to be. And so people should be able to, you know, make their choice about, you know, especially if you're having a surgery that's planned and, you know, you're getting second opinion, all these things, you should know how much it's going to cost you before you go in. And a lot of the hospitals then decided that they would take the penalty instead of actually posting their prices. And so, yeah, so a lot of this is like, it does need some regulation. It does need changes in law, in actual legislation. But, you know, rules in HHS can also be helpful, but, you know, they don't have to follow it if it's not the law. But they're even like in, you know, the Ohio State Legislature passed a transparency bill years ago also, and still 90% of the hospitals are not compliant with the transparency law, because they'd rather take the penalty. It's cheaper to take the penalty than to have patients know their prices up front.
Yeah, that is crazy and just seems like common sense. It's, yeah, but I guess you're going to have to speak to the people who will then have to demand from the representatives for this change.
Exactly. So what I tried to do, ended up having to cut it short. I started a podcast called Free to Care Podcast. This was a couple of years ago. And I was actually inviting people on from Free to Care who were leaders of the different organizations in Free to Care to explain these things and basically take it directly to the people. And then, and you know, and I tried to give people bills, at least the buzzwords to say to take to their legislators. It got cut short because my dad got sick with bad dementia and I ended up having to take care of him. And you know, and then there was a pandemic on top of that. So I had to cut it. And unfortunately, but I mean, I had fun doing it. It's on YouTube. It's on Spotify. Free to Care, the podcast. So a lot of the stuff that I'm talking to you about now, we talked about, you know, there, as well. So there's links and, you know, sort of the buzzwords there, but really, honestly, and right now healthcare is sort of on the back burner, even though it's a number one issue for Americans. But right now, I mean, you know, it's kind of pushed down because economics is huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are the biggest topics right now. Economics, war, immigration, you know, people.
Right. No, it's all linked, right? Like,
yep.
It's, you know, they're all linked to each other. So if you're talking economics, immigration has an effect on the healthcare system, like all of these things. So it's not something that should get pushed under the rug.
Oh, and just after speaking of that, I just saw a story published that hospitals in Denver are overrun by, like, they have reached capacity because of the migrant crisis from all of the immigrants that came through. So basically, I mean, like, they're like closing hospital systems, you know, down because, you know, to take care of people. Everything they said was going to happen with COVID is happening because of this crisis. And that's going to obviously affect the people who live in Denver, who are citizens of the United States, right?
Right. So what do you find as when you work with Democrat politicians versus Republicans, like, what are the things that each group kind of like latches onto that you're doing versus reject? You talked about it a little bit, but I'm just curious, is because both sides talk about it, both sides claim to have the solutions, right? And you're just kind of saying, are you just hitting walls with, it doesn't matter who you talk to?
I've honestly, we've had better relationships with Republicans than we've had with Democrats. I've had, you know, interesting, like with my, I have a Democrat senator and a Republican senator currently. And my Democrat senator is, has been a senator since we started doing all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And he, when I met with his office, I mean, I really got nothing, at least on the, you know, in end of the education and transparency about the PBMs and the nurse practitioner supervision issue. I got zero. I got nothing. Mm-hmm. When I did publish a piece in our local newspaper about the pharmacy benefit managers and their control over insurance, over medications on the formulary, I got a letter from my senator thanking me for doing that, you know, that kind of thing. But in terms of legislation and him signing on to legislation that support legislation that would end that, no, nothing. It's really painful working with Congress. It's been painful working with our state legislator. But I will tell you, or the gifts that we've had, at least in the state of Ohio and some states around the country, is our state attorney general going after some of these groups, especially when it comes to Medicaid exposure and Medicaid fraud and overspending in Medicaid. That's where they're attacking and exposing the pharmacy benefit managers and the GPOs. And that has been an easier path because these are big corporate entities that actually don't contribute to the care of people. So it's easier to attack these faceless companies that are just out to make money. That's really all they are about, right? And so when you've got people who are suffering and can't buy their insulin, like you can get, you know, people on a panel and tell their story, or doctors tell their stories about their patients, and that, you know, the emotional trigger is enough against the big corporate giant, right? So you can make some headway there. But to get kind of compassion for issues that affect doctors specifically, no. And, you know, and not realizing how that's going to trickle down, and doctors and nurses, you know, specifically, you're not going to get a ton of sympathy and a lot of movement where that goes. So that part's frustrating. But honestly, I think like anything, building relationships with people is how you get the paths forward, and you have to just kind of be persistent with them. But one real positive story that I'd like to share, though, is, you know, I was asked to speak to, you know, a panel with Senator Roger Marshall of Kentucky. He is working with Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is staunch Medicare for all, right? And Roger Marshall is a Republican. They want to be able to lower. I mean, they really are working hard to try and find a middle ground so that we can actually get to the point where we're lowering the cost of healthcare. So we just basically brainstormed with Dr. Marshall. He took that back to Bernie Sanders, and they just put out a bill that supports one of the things that we talked about. So like, that's encouraging to me. Gosh, to see that. You got somebody, like you got people on the extreme ends of the political spectrum working together on something that's actually going to benefit American citizens. So that's a bit of, you know, positivity.
It's rare that I hear stories like that anymore these days. So that's actually wonderful. And you actually briefly mentioned this towards the beginning, but along the lines of the direct care, what about cost sharing? Is that a part of a solution, because it's more of a cash based type of payment system?
So some people do like the medical cost sharing programs. It honestly is not something that I've looked into deeply. I felt like it just didn't fit my family, because both of us, you know, my husband and I, you know, have always been employed and had, you know, insurance through there. And so my insurance has, and my husband has, we have his insurance now. And so we've never had to like really think about that per se. Especially while the kids are young and, you know, needing orthodontia and all that stuff. And like, so we just never looked into it. So honestly, I can't argue for it, but there are people and members of FreedaCare that I've worked with who do stand by it and support it. It's an option for people to look into, but it's just not something I feel comfortable, and I think a lot of people's criticism, a lot of these programs are Christian based and some people don't want to, take part in that. So that's a big part of it too, for people who just don't look into it. But apparently I think MediShare is the one I see the most hear the most commercials about. So people are signing on, they're doing something.
Different. I've seen it. I feel like anecdotally just talking to people, seeing stuff chatter online, that it's really kind of growing, it's exploding and more people are moving that direction. Actually, for a brief time, my family did use Christian healthcare ministries ourselves when we were in between jobs, and it was great. It's all good. It is still kind of expensive. It's not $90 a month or whatever,
Because you're sharing the cost with other people. So people who are chronically ill and people who are healthy.
Yeah. So it was a bit more expensive. And like, if you're in childbearing years, like I am, you have to, it's tiered. And so you have to pay more if you want to be covered, should you fall pregnant, that kind of thing. So there was an increased cost because we did do that. And I ended up getting pregnant. So it's good that we did, but it's great, but it's not that cheap. Like if you're a family that's really like on a tight budget, it was a substantial cost. But so I've also noticed, again, this is maybe just the circles I run in, I don't know if this is trending nationally, but people do kind of recognize, getting back to kind of the level of the type of care that they're getting, the diligence or lack thereof that they feel like they're getting from their providers, that people are like, kind of like, F it, I'm going away from all of this. And I've seen the number of people pursuing like naturopaths exploding. I haven't done that myself, but I'm wondering what even is, like, are they regulated differently? Or people just... What is it about that is or isn't a good option for people who are like, I want to be treated like a human being or whatever.
So here's the deal. I think people are frustrated with Western medicine's view that what we say is the best way, right? And people do want to be healthy. And I just don't think that the way we've been delivering healthcare has the goal of making people healthy. It really is. The way the system is run right now, it's basically you come in my office when you're sick and I'll help you. I'll help treat your disease. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't have time really to get you healthy. So you have to do that on your own, right? And so I just think the focus isn't there. And I think people are really frustrated with that. On top of the fact, I think the pandemic exposing public health and physicians who really don't look at the science that they actually are advocating for, misinterpreting it or misunderstanding it or just completely ignoring it and saying this is the way, this is the right way because it's the way I was taught. People are a bit jaded with traditional medicine. I don't blame them one bit. Like I've been completely disappointed in my colleagues, through the way they treated the pandemic. And so I understand that need to find somebody who's going to one, take time with you and listen to your needs and sort of help you get healthy and, think of other things that could be causing your problems instead of these, traditional ways. The problem with naturopaths is it's regulated differently in each state. Some of them are physicians with an MD or DO. Some of them are not. You could just call yourself a naturopath in some places and then that's it. And you can just, so there's no real regulatory body around them or accrediting body. It is a growing field. So, maybe there'll be something that's coming down the line. And pretty much what they do doesn't necessarily get reimbursed for either. So there are some functional medicine doctors, and there's also some other very specific parts of medicine, like acupuncture, chiropractors, those, are regulated And they have a, like a formal training process and that kind of thing that they have to do. And some of that is actually reimbursed. But when it comes to like supplements and infusions and things that people are saying, you know, those things aren't really governed 100% by science. They're doing their own literature, you know, their own,
yeah,
like kind of their own thing really in their own practices. And people are getting charged a bunch, like tons of money, and they will pay out of pocket for this stuff. But I really think the need and the rise is just because people are so disenfranchised with the way the health system is now, and how we look at health, in America. And it's completely understandable that we're not really trying to get people healthy. We're trying to treat disease. And it's like there's a pill for everything now. There's a pill or an injection for everything. And people are looking for other ways out of that. And we don't have the guidance. We don't have the leadership in place to get back to sort of that, like kind of like using the body for what it actually is designed to do, but also helping people and encouraging people to be healthy in the first place and prevent all these illnesses. Right. There's not a lot of that. So
yeah,
they're scary. There's some scary, there are really some scary ones out there that are doing some things.
Yeah, so I believe it.
Just beware. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. People are just desperate and looking for anything, like you said. Okay. So you're a part of a couple other organizations, Parents for Accountability and Independent Schools. Is that directly related to the advocacy you're doing within the medical space, or is that something else?
Completely different. It is part of it sort of spun out of the pandemic. It's a group of parents here who are parents of kids in private schools and all kinds of independent schools from religious-based, secular to Montessori, all different kinds of schools that we have here in Northeast Ohio. The schools actually hosted a speaker who was billed as an expert on kind of gender affirming care. And basically they presented as she was going to educate parents on really how to talk to their children who are seeking to identify. And that presentation was not necessarily, it was less of an education about the subject matter and like kind of the real scientific data around that subject matter than it was kind of pushing parents to do, take their child down a certain path. And we were very bothered that the, as parents, bothered that the schools would host this person and then not have a counter or a person with a different viewpoint to come and talk to parents. And this, and actually this person was built, did a workshop for the teachers too. So we were nervous that like, this was going to start a form of indoctrination in the schools that we weren't comfortable with as parents. And so we came together, we started meeting, wrote letters and that kind of thing. And we really want to do right now, you know, people, you know, I've heard people like try to compare us to Moms for Liberty, but that is completely not what we are. We have multiple different, you know, voices and politics. We're not like affiliated with one political viewpoint. We're just parents who want our kids to learn the right things. We want them to learn truth and fact and then have multiple viewpoints on a subject matter that's cultural and social, and then be able to make their own informed choices. And we also want to protect the kids that are little from being exposed to topics that we just don't think is appropriate for their age. We started our website, but really, you know, that's just sort of kind of to get information out there. And we are reading Dr. Miriam Grossman's book now. So really we're acting in a book club, and we're going to host our own speaker this spring. And we're just trying to kind of get the word out, but we're also trying to educate the schools on a better way to tackle this subject. Because what we found when we met with the leadership at our different schools is that the leadership is sort of stuck. They don't really know. This is all new for them. And so they don't want to obviously upset donors. They don't want to upset parents. They don't want to upset teachers. They don't want to upset the kids, right? And but they really don't, it's not something they were educated on. And so what we find as our job is to gather resources and share that with them and basically hold them accountable for teaching our kids one, the basics of school, the things that they need to survive as adults once they leave school, but also being, you know, accountable to their own charters, their own philosophies. And keeping the parents informed, really teaching our kids how to become really, you know, independent thinkers, think for themselves, and how to debate respectfully in school. That's our goal.
Now it's just local.
It's just local. We're very small right now, but.
Do you have literature you can share with, if there's another mom listening to this or something, if they go to their website, will they find any resources?
Yeah, it's the website is PFACLE.com. So it's Parents for Accountability in Cleveland, .com.
Okay, great. And is that related to, is what you're doing there related to this, the kind of local think tank that you're working with as well?
Oh no, that's completely different. So the think tank.
Okay. A woman of many hats.
I know. My husband is like, okay, like I'm like supposed to be like not stressing over stuff. And I just keep getting myself involved in multiple things. So,
I can relate.
Along with being a mom, being a wife, taking care of the house, that kind of thing. That group it's actually political. It's all political. It's called The Solution. And it's Cleveland based, right now. It's been around since 2019, but I just joined last year, and it is also a nonpartisan group of mainly Black people, but there are other ethnicities involved. But our goal is to try and get legislation, policies, and politicians elected, who have the interest of Black people in our communities in mind. And so right now, and it's primary season, we are interviewing candidates through a written questionnaire and video interview so we can get to know what specific things that they have to say about questions that we have, the things that will support us. So I'm in charge right now of the Supreme Court nominees, and I'm, you know, reaching out to them to get, and we'll interview the people who are interested in getting an interview. It's a 15-minute interview, and then we're making those public, and we're not endorsing anyone. We're just giving that information out to the public. Okay. So oftentimes when you go to vote, right, you don't know, especially for the judges, you don't know, like, you don't know what they think, you know, who has time to comb, like, you know, judicial, you know, judgments and law, you know, reviews and all this stuff like that. I don't even, that's a completely different world for me. And a lot of people just don't know. They just go and like, they take their party's ticket into the booth, and then they just check down the line for whoever they pick, or they just skip those altogether. Especially in the local elections, these are the people who affect your life. So you know, if you're worried about if you've had a felony or you had a misdemeanor and you felt like the system did you wrong, and that you know that judge, well, do you want that judge to not be on the bench? You got to go in and vote. And so, but you got to know about them too, and you got to know who to vote for. So we feel like it's long overdue for Black people to get something from the political system, and we have, you know, several people in the group who run the group who have some definitely some political sway, and they know when, you know, those people's names are attached to a candidate, then that's going to draw some voters. And so that's what we're leveraging, that kind of power and money to try and get agendas that are specifically for Black people. Everybody else advocates for their for their communities. Mm-hmm. It's our turn to do it for ourselves. And what I love about this group is that we are, that is our strict focus. And I'm a Republican, but there's plenty of Democrats involved. I know, like the R word, whatever. But everybody's viewpoint is respected. And as long as you have the same goal, we are in it together. We don't really care about anything else. So.
Okay. Yep. And so it's mainly like an educational piece. So people can go and say, okay, I'm trying to figure out who I'm going to vote for. I'm going to watch the videos, the interviews, that kind of thing, and determine who's going to actually do something for the
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah. And it's, yes. And, you know, and straight up is, you know, it's really, it's advocacy. It's advocating for our community. But really with the idea with those is we want people to be educated and know specifically how these people stand on issues that affect Black people. And then take that with you to the voting booth.
I think it's actually, because I was going to ask, but and then you answered it before I even asked about, like, are you endorsing candidates or whatever. I think it's actually so wise that you're not, because that's where these types of organizations eventually get corrupted, because certain types of people take control, whether they're right-leaning, left-leaning, or whatever, and they're only going to endorse people that they, that their specific, you know, worldview or political affiliation supports. And so if you're just saying, here's the information, make your choice, that is awesome. Because even someone like me, I could get lazy and be like, well, I trust the solution. I'm not going to watch the videos. Who do they tell me to vote for? Which is the same problem you're trying to prevent from the get-go. So
absolutely. Really, and the videos are the interviews are 15 minutes. So if you don't have 15 minutes, I mean, come on, I don't know. Like, I mean, 15 minutes each. So, and it's not, you know, the people who agree to do it are only the only ones who are going to get it. So like, if you don't make time to fill out our questionnaire, the other thing is if you've, you know, really like been open about something that's completely against supporting Black people, you're not even going to get considered. So we're not even going to, you're not even going to get a chance. So it's not a lot. It's not a ton of people and a ton of names. So if you're going to vote, at least make an informed vote. And like, we're not, there's no excuses. You know, there's only so much that an individual person who's working and taking care of a family can do to stay informed about politics. I'm a politics junkie, but not everybody else is.
Exactly.
But if you're going into that voting booth, at least know who you're going to vote on.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. And yeah, just so great for this time of year as the elections are ramping up. You do so many things. Like, you're Wonder Woman. we could talk about all of these for like another hour, but let's wrap it up and do your 10 quick fire questions.
Right,
and then you can leave our audience with your final thoughts. Okay.
Okay.
Question number one, should churches, including mosques, synagogues, etc., remain tax exempt?
Oh, that's a great question. My answer is no. That's going to be my quick answer.
Okay. What are your thoughts on white people having dreadlocks?
Oh, I don't care. Whatever.
Who's the most overrated Black intellectual?
The most overrated. Well, gosh, that's a tough one. I think it depends on the circle you're in. So when I meet white Republicans, the first person, oh, did you know Thomas Sowell? I mean, he's an intellectual. He's got some brilliant ideas, but he's not like this influential figure for advancing and getting people to join, you know, the right side of politics. So I would name him.
Ooh, that's the most scandalous thing you've said. Yeah. We're going to get, you can't mess with Thomas Sowell.
I know, right? Right. Okay. Right.
Next question. Booker T or Du Bois?
Oh, I'm Booker T all the way.
Is kneeling during the national anthem an appropriate form of protest?
Yes. You're an American citizen. You can protest any way you like. Peacefully protest is allowed in the Constitution.
Is the word Negro a slur?
No. You know, it's so funny. I was just having this conversation with my 16-year-old who, like, there's a friend, a schoolmate who heard a teacher say Negro, and they thought it was a slur and, like, you know, told on this teacher. And I said, that's not a slur, honey. That's just a name. Like, you know, if, it's a name that some of us have agreed to go by even today. Yep.
What is your least favorite color?
Ooh. Split pea soup green.
vomit. Yeah. My mom calls it sea poop. Name a sport you would like to see in the Olympics that currently isn't.
Oh. Yeah, my daughter just started doing something called Lyra. It's basically aerial acrobatics, but on a hoop that's dangling from the ceiling. So she just started doing that. I'd like to see that.
Okay. Should the United States return to the gold standard?
Yes.
And then your final question, do you think you could kill a person in self-defense?
Yes.
All right. Those are your 10 questions. You got through them. Do you have any final thoughts, words of wisdom for our audience?
No real words of wisdom, but I will just leave you with the thought. I am working hard on writing a book, and that book is going to be My Prescription for Healing America. And I truly believe, you know, the model for this next chapter of my life is that you have to work on being a healthy individual. And when you combine your healthy self with a family entity, you know, your family is healthy. And healthy families are what make up America and make America healthy. So we have to start with the individual. I think we need to get to working on that. So that's what I'll
leave you with. Well, awesome. I can't wait for the book. Please reach back. I mean, we follow you, so we're going to know when you're promoting it and putting it out there. But we hope that you'll return to the podcast to talk about that when it publishes. And also just keep us in mind as you're working on so many awesome projects. We would love to promote them, talk about them. And we're just fans of what you do. And we wish you all the best.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. I love your site and I love the podcast. So keep up the great work.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.